Hey folks, good morning. Welcome to another exciting episode of Long Shots. This is Nikhil Arora and I have with me my usual suspect. I think this is something that I did not use for some time. Mr. Sharad Tukran. How are you, Sharad?
You know the answer to that question.
Yes, I know that. Not too bad.
Not too bad.
Can't complain. And the usual lot.
It's good and I like the weather turnaround that's happened in the past 3-4 days.
Right.
So I'm happy and I'm also looking forward to today's episode because we have another person.
Yes, I'm sure our listeners are also looking forward to another voice. We have badgered for now two or three episodes.
And now
it's just both of us.
Huh? Yeah. Now we have revisiting our eclectic mix of guests.
Yes, that's correct. But before we go ahead on that thread, an obvious housekeeping, do subscribe to our channel. We are now searchable by Transpin Podcasts. Do look out for us on Apple, Deezer, Spotify, and Google, and many other podcast apps that we are streaming on, so that you get that nice little notification every time an episode goes live. And do switch off your mobile phones and all of that.
And we have two podcast series, so we have four voices at the bare minimum now.
Yeah, four voices. So today, talking about the fifth voice,
yeah,
we have Mr. Sameer Agarwal from Redfin. Hey, Sameer, how's it going, man?
Hi, everyone. Hi, Nikhil. Hi, Sharad.
So, Sameer, first things first, I'm very happy that you work just around the block.
That's right.
Right? We have, I think, pretty much identical office locations, just one block away. So
just one block away. Easy walk in the morning.
So, you pretty much saved on the commute to come here, which kind of, I think, is the most optimum use of your time as well. But thank you so much for, coming over. And I think we share a lot of common threads around here, right? I think you are from IIT Kharagpur.
That's correct. I'm from IIT Kharagpur. I was joined in 2006.
Right. And I think you were there in the UK as well for some time.
Yeah. Spent about 9 years in the UK, mostly in London working with HSBC.
Right. And unsecured credit.
And secured, unsecured both.
Right.
But mostly unsecured credit.
And you decided to kind of take that, extrapolate that journey when you move back, pretty much, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. I've had, I've worked quite a lot in the subprime sector in the UK as well.
Oh, wow.
Obviously, HSBC is quite prime, but I've worked with a smaller firm that was focused on subprime lending.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting because there are about 8 million people in the UK, and that's very large by UK standards, who do not have access to affordable and formal lending.
So I think UK is what, 75 million in total?
Less than that, actually. 65 million or
wow.
So.
Okay.
We're talking about 15% of population, right. Probably 25-30% of adult population,
yeah,
who is still financially excluded in the UK.
Right.
And basically, the reason is the same as anywhere else.
Mm.
There's very little information about them. Either they are new migrants into the UK,
right.
So there's no data available about them, or they are people with very poor credit history.
Right.
And basically, we have the same problem in India, but obviously magnified several times over.
Right.
And having worked in that in the subprime sector in the UK, I realized that if you want to underwrite customers for unsecured lending in this segment, you have to do something really, really different. Something, I know we talk a lot about alternate techniques, alternate lending.
Right.
But I think in this case, you have to do innovative lending or innovative underwriting.
Right.
And I think I had the opportunity of doing a lot of experimentation in the UK, which
right.
was, I would say, quite successful. And so I thought, maybe we should try that in India as well.
And so that can be sort of replicated in the Indian marketplace?
Yeah, I think it's not a question of necessarily replicating, but some of the techniques, some of the innovation, and some of the out-of-box thinking, I think, is applicable globally, not just in India.
Yeah.
And of course, as we are building in India, we are adapting for India as well.
So like walk us through a journey, so you went to business school, straight from there. What was your first job? Where did you start your career?
So first job was with HSBC.
Right.
In Kolkata, working as an analyst,
mm.
so doing a lot of data analytics or data science, as it's called these days.
Right.
Building models, scorecards, rating models.
Mm.
For the first couple of years, then moved to the UK. Did more of analytics. Then I was managing unsecured lending analytics for HSBC UK. Did that for a few years, and then ultimately made a natural sort of shift into credit risk management.
Right.
And over there, had the opportunity to work across six continents with HSBC, working on consumer credit globally.
What was the duration of your stint there in this particular capacity?
I was there for about 3.5 years in consumer credit risk.
Right.
And I've worked in South America, North America, Africa,
right.
Asia, Europe.
Oh, wow. So you've covered the map.
I've covered the map.
Yeah.
Australia as well.
Yeah.
So I've seen a lot of different types of markets, different types of customers, different types of products, and
right.
it's all been very exciting.
Right.
And across these markets, sort of, you've got a close look, or your experience was typically in lending side, or?
Yeah, it was all lending. Mostly unsecured lending, a
okay.
little bit of home loans, mortgages,
yeah.
secured lending as well, but primarily unsecured lending.
You know, just for the benefit of our listeners,
mm-hmm.
like I know we also kind of keep on, you know, dabbling between different terms and jargon,
huh.
for the lack of a better word. So when you look at, when you're saying unsecured lending, right? What do you mean by that?
So unsecured lending, in the context that I speak, is basically lending to an individual, so that's consumer credit.
Right.
And basically, the loan is not backed by any asset.
Right.
So as an example, a home loan is backed by a home. So that's asset-backed and that's secure.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas an unsecured loan, there's no security. So you basically are giving that money basically on the worthiness of the individual only.
Right.
And not on the worthiness of the asset that is underlying.
So by definition, it's riskier.
It's riskier to an extent because obviously it's unsecured. But generally the quantum of lending is lower,
right?
And therefore I think that sort of kind of
offsets
some of the risk.
Right. So it's more like it's more of like law of large numbers, so
yeah.
as to say, right?
Yeah.
That's
right. So you have a very diversified portfolio.
Correct. Correct. So I mean, you came back and then you kicked off a venture.
Hmm.
And let's face it, the dynamic of consumer that you are targeting in this venture is pretty unique. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the best way to go about it is, why don't you like tell us a
yeah.
bit more in detail about Reffin, what you have been doing, and how did you spot this particular
sure.
segment?
Sure.
You know,
so I think, you know, when I started Reffin, the idea was very clear that we are going to work on financial inclusion.
Mm.
Right. And that means a lot of things to a lot of people. For me, it just meant basically underwriting, being able to underwrite anybody irrespective of what type of data exists about them or not.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it could be any person for whom you don't find formal data like credit history or past transaction history data.
Mm.
That's the kind of consumer we want to underwrite. And that's how our platform is built. So our platform basically looks at a lot of alternative or innovative ways of underwriting a customer.
Right.
And we focus on human behavior rather than just very narrowly on their financial behavior.
Interesting. You're saying underwriting. So, I mean, just again, for the benefit of everyone on air, that you're not an intermediary.
No,
right.
We're not an intermediary, so we actually have our own NBFC.
Right.
So we are...
So you put it on your balance sheet.
Yeah, we
right.
put it on our balance
right.
sheet.
Right.
That's, is it? Is that Aristo? What's it called? The NBFC arm?
The NBFC is called Aristo Security.
Aristo, okay. Just one more thing. You said sort of, you know, financial inclusion means for people who don't have that data to include them. Does that also include poor data? People with poor data?
It does. It does. Because ultimately, the question is that, is a person able to borrow money? And when I say borrow money, I mean in a more formal and affordable manner, not going to a loan shark or a family member and so
mm-hmm.
on and so forth.
Right.
And people get rejected either, as I said, you know, they don't have any data about them or
yeah.
there's too much of very bad data about them.
Okay.
And I think the idea is how do you then segregate between a potentially good and a potentially bad customer from a credit perspective, given either no data or a lot of bad data.
Yeah.
So, I'm going to kind of, you know, just take a very consumer-centric view at a business. Like, I've opened a website, right? On the website, obviously, when it comes to the product classification, one can see that you're talking mainly about personal unsecured loans,
yeah.
right? But you obviously classified them by use cases, right?
Correct.
You have looked at e-rickshaws, you looked at e-scooters. There's an electric vehicle bias in the mix,
yeah.
right? And there are obviously, you know, home renovation as well as vacation lending, which has been included
Correct.
In the mix. But I guess EVs is something of a... focus area for you.
So I mean electric vehicle is certainly a focus area for
mm.
us. You know, as I said, the main objective was financial inclusion,
mm.
and then therefore we said let's identify categories of customers
right.
That are broadly financially excluded, where there is a huge
mm.
demand for credit,
mm.
Very little supply to anybody, not just financially excluded people, just generally low credit penetration in the market,
right?
And a sector that we could scale quite easily,
mm.
and we found that electric vehicle is one of those segments. And just to give you some insight, basically 85% of our customers are taking their first loan with us. And this is 85% of the people who come to buy an electric vehicle or an electric three-wheeler. So which means that this population is largely financially excluded.
Right.
Now, add to this that there are about 2 million electric three-wheelers in India today that are running on roads today.
Right.
And in my opinion, the market could have been much larger had finance been available. So it's, you know, almost like thinking about the automobile industry 30, 40 years back when you had to, you know, save up 1 lakh rupees to buy a car.
Yeah.
Because there were no loans or nobody wanted to take a loan.
Right.
Right. So I think first bringing credit available to that market, and second making it available to the people who are generally excluded by formal lenders. I think that's basically what we are trying to do, and I think this market, this segment is our first go-to segment, the first segment that we're trying to scale.
Right.
But I think the segment is exactly what helps us solve exactly the problem that we wanted to solve.
So like when you're saying, so when you're looking at like say a e-three-wheeler loan, you're saying it's unsecured.
It's not unsecured. This loan is actually not unsecured.
Right.
It's not unsecured to the extent that there is an asset, underlying asset, right, which is the electric vehicle itself.
But like, isn't electric vehicle, I mean, I'm not saying electric vehicle per se, but isn't an electric three-wheeler, it's pretty different from like in terms of like just looking at resale value, in terms of monetizing it, at a
shelf life.
Yes. Yeah. So you're absolutely right. So, I mean, if you think of it, yes, it is, it's got an asset underlying, but the asset quality is not the same as, let's say, a Honda car or a Suzuki car, right? There is no formal resale market. The underlying value of the product is quite questionable. And in fact, most of the value of the product is in the battery. And once the battery is gone, basically the vehicle loses value, right? So to an extent, it's not a fully secured type of loan. It's a, I would say, a semi-secured loan. And therefore, we still have to rely a lot on who we are lending to, the individual that we're lending to.
I guess your processes are pretty much what you would do with an unsecured.
Correct. So we do a lot of unsecured loans as well, and we've done quite a few in the past. And in terms of the way we underwrite, it doesn't change. Of course, when we do a vehicle loan, there are certain other procedural things that you have to do, like hypothecation of the vehicle, insurance of the vehicle, so on and so forth. But barring that, the main underwriting process doesn't change.
If you look at like the typical three-wheeler driver, who I guess is your customer, you're looking at this purely as a B2C proposition.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. So you're not actually going to an operator.
No, we're not going to an operator.
Yeah. So if you're looking at an individual three-wheeler driver, now a lot of these guys are migrants. A lot of these guys will be having poor documentation. A lot of these guys will be having no documentation.
Correct.
Right. So I'm sure you know tech has a role to play there for you. But how does that actually manifest itself on ground?
So maybe three or four things I'd like to probably explain over here. So first of all, I think if you look at the electric three-wheeler itself, the biggest market is Delhi. And we generally try not to lend in Delhi.
Okay.
And the reason for that is because, as you said, the population, it's a migrant population base, and it's a very volatile population, right? And there's also very, it's also very, the vehicle itself is a very small vehicle in size, etc. So it's very easy to hide the vehicle, get rid of it, sell it to somebody else, so on and so forth, right? So Delhi, I believe, is not a, in my opinion, is not a very good market. However, there's a huge market outside of Delhi in smaller towns, tier 2, tier 3 towns, small towns in UP, Bihar, West Bengal, so on and so forth. I think for me, that's where we are lending, and that's where the big market is, and that's where the growth in the market is.
Right.
So Delhi is already quite oversaturated, but the other markets are coming up quite quickly.
Right.
And that's where we focus on, because the customer is generally more entrenched over there. Right. So that's one from a flight risk perspective. But beyond that, I think, so when we look at these customers, the one good thing is that all of them have bank accounts. Right. Thanks to the Jan Dhan Yojana, everybody has a bank account. And we also mandate everybody to have a PAN card. And, you know, surprisingly, we've not found anybody without a PAN card so far. and in fact, or maybe there are some people who don't have a PAN card, but it's very easy to get one these days, right? So you apply for it, you get it in a week. So I think those two things are mandatory from our perspective. But they don't have any credit bureau data, they don't have any CIBIL records, so on and so forth. So at least 85% of them don't. And even though they have bank accounts, they have no transactions on their accounts, right? So yes, they have an account. So we can disburse to that account, we can collect from that account, but there's nothing we can use from those bank statements to assess affordability, income, and so on and so forth.
And sort of the role of tech again, like migration, population, challenge, can like IoT enabled device.
So I think there are four or five things that we do from a tech perspective, right? And you know, when we built our platform, we had sort of three key pillars from a technology perspective. One was biometrics, second was psychometrics, and third is gamification. So what we do in our platform is, from a biometric perspective, we capture a short video of the customer. to basically look at motion presence. We do a face matching with their ID photos, as well. We get a couple of ID photos. So that basically helps us establish that there is actually a real person over there, mm-hmm. and it is the person who claims, it's basically the same person who they're claiming to be. So that's one. Then we take our customers through a two-stage psychometric assessment to have a more sort of holistic view of their personality.
Right.
We look at honesty, we look at attitude towards risk, and we are also doing a joint research project with IIT Kharagpur where we are basically building a measure of intention to repay a loan using psychometric assessment.
Okay.
How do you structure such an assessment?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming you operate in a lot of, I would say, heartland.
It's the way you present the test.
Yeah.
Okay, you have to make it really simple. So what we are doing now, as an example, is that if you basically go through our app, you'll see a few photos and a few questions based on those photos, right? And basically, the choice or the selection of the photos tell us a little bit about their personality. What we're building now is basically comic strips into the app as well.
Okay.
Right. So it's basically a story. You listen, you read that story. It will be in Hindi and in English. So you read the story and then you answer some questions based on the story or situation.
This sounds like more like cognitive
behavioral assessment,
right?
That's right.
I mean, like you have a team of people who does this. Like, how does this work?
Yeah. So basically, as I said, you know, we are doing a joint research project with IIT Kharagpur.
Right.
So some of the professors and students over there are building this for us. It's very scientifically driven, and then basically the test is scientifically driven, and then the assessment is based on algorithms which look at basically responses, correlation of responses to performance on loan.
Okay.
Typically, how long does this entire process last? Let's say if someone signs up and wants to get his or her.
Our normal process basically takes about 5 to 7 minutes from start to getting an approval.
Okay.
And then probably 3-4 minutes post that to do your agreements and so on and so forth. So basically under, I would say 10 to 15 minutes is the average time it takes.
And to deploy capital?
To deploy capital, it depends, right? So if it's a loan for an electric vehicle, it takes time because there's some more documentation that needs to be done post the approval. But if it's unsecured, then it can be...
But the approval itself takes...
Under 10 minutes.
That's fascinating.
So the test component, the psychometric test component, is included in the 10-minute period.
Yes.
And you must have now underwritten, I don't know if that's public information. Like, what's the
loan book?
How much have you disbursed so far? Ballpark.
So we just started operations late last year. So we've done about 8 crores of disbursement so far.
And these are typically, what's the tenure?
So average tenure on a loan is about 21 months.
21 months, right, a little less than 2 years. Yeah. So you must have seen the book perform.
Yeah, we've seen the book perform to date. And so to date, we have only one account that is classified as NPA.
Right,
And we have loans running for almost 12, 13 months now.
So average ticket size must be what, 1-2 lakhs?
Average ticket size is 1 lakh.
Oh, wow. So just one NPA.
And it's a substantial amount, right? Especially for people who are borrowing for the first time.
Yeah.
It's a substantial amount.
Right. And how do you, in terms of servicing the debt, on ground, is there some innovation there also?
Yeah, there is actually.
You had to...
Yeah, so there is some innovation. So, the third pillar was gamification. That's where basically we incentivize customers to not just repay their loan in a timely manner, but also in the right manner.
Okay.
Right? So, as an example, you pay your loan on time through a direct debit or a NACH or an e-mandate, right?
Right.
Which is basically directly from their bank account to our bank account.
Yeah.
And then we reward customers for that.
Right.
If they do it multiple times over, then we give them bonus rewards, etc. And the reward then can be exchanged for things to do with the loan. Which have, as an example, get certainty of your next loan, a higher credit limit, get an additional loan product. So we also give an overdraft line to customers for emergency use, or reduction in their interest rates, or give them the ability to vouch for their friends.
They're sort of effectively building their own credit profiles now.
Now they're building their own credit profiles, basically. Right. And of course, one of the other consequences of all of this is because they've taken the loan from us, they have now a civil record, and if they're paying well, even that is good. That gets better over time, so they get access to more and more products.
Are there sort of clients or customers who still show an appetite to repay cash because that's how they're making money, or are they very intuitively tuned into the digital ecosystem?
No, I think in smaller towns, digital is still, I mean, it's just a mobile phone and there's not too much usage of digital and banking and all those things.
Yeah.
So there, that is a big challenge for us.
Okay.
Right. A lot of customers do like to pay in cash. So what we are doing is we are basically trying to do two, three things. As I said, one is with the gamification, we're trying to encourage customers to put money into their bank accounts. That's one.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing, we've also tied up with a couple of payment banks so that customers can actually go and deposit cash over there so that we still get money in through banking channel.
Right.
But having said that, even today, a large proportion of our collection is in cash.
Right.
My target is basically to achieve in the next couple of years at least 85% collection through banking channel directly through banking.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. Today, it's probably around 65-70%.
Okay.
And where do you see, this obviously is one, this is a model that you are using in a very specific segment.
Yeah.
I'm sure you, as any savvy entrepreneur, you must be thinking all the time of the applications.
Yeah.
Right?
Growth areas.
Yeah, so I think, if I think of a platform, as I said, we've done something that's probably not been done anywhere else in a lending platform using biometrics, psychometrics, gamification, and all these, behavioral science aspects, right? So there's always this question mark in the minds of people whether this is going to work. So therefore, what we decided was, let's focus on one segment where we can actually prove this works.
Right.
And once we've proven that, we basically start scaling into other segments.
Right.
And frankly, I mean, if you look around in India, credit penetration in India, especially consumer credit penetration is just so low. It's under 15% of GDP. Even China, Japan are probably 50 plus. And much of the developed world is, at 100%. Right. So there's a huge room to grow consumer credit. And I think as consumer credit grows, it doesn't mean that the same people are going to borrow more and more. It means new people are going to start borrowing.
Right.
And when new people start borrowing, it will become very difficult for traditional lenders to underwrite them. And I think our platform would find application in all the cases who are basically first-time borrowers.
And when you look at, there are always these, two, three schools of thought, right? Like I recall, when you look at fintech, when you look at online lending itself, a lot of players are kind of, I would say, overselling the tech card that they have, right? And, in those forums, like I've been to, like, you must be knowing of, like, Digital Lenders Association, right? So I've been to one of the, I think the inaugural conference. And there you could see that, we had traditional lenders who were there in the same conference who were like saying that, look, credit works and credit is something that one can execute only once you have started, underwriting. It's an experience-oriented dynamic, right? So pure tech, just because, you have like, you're scraping through social media data or whatever, there are so many stories which many other companies have. It does not really work.
Yeah.
You seem to be doing something in the middle, right? You're not like completely abandoning the traditional credit as well.
So let me give you a little bit of a backstory on this one. When I was in the UK, and because fintech sector basically is far more advanced in the UK than it is over here.
Right.
So I used to, I was adding risk for an organization. So I used to meet a lot of fintech players almost every day, claiming to have all these different types of data, models, etc. But all of them had the same pitch. And the pitch was, I will increase your approval rate by 10%, I will reduce your default rate by 20%.
Okay.
And that was like the stock answer that everybody gave me. And I said, all right, so how will you do it? And everybody said, let's do a pilot and we prove it.
Okay.
And I said, I'm not doing a pilot with you. I might as well just do it myself, right? I can pull Facebook data. Why do you need to pull it for me as an example? Of course, in the UK, it's not permitted anymore. But I mean, point being that if it's just a question of data collection, we can collect data, right? And frankly, being a lending company, you must always have strong analytics. I know that that's traditionally not been the case in India, but in the Western economies, that has always been the case, right? You'll find the strongest analytics teams in banks, whether it's Citibank, HSBC, Capital One, so on and so forth.
Right.
So I think for me, it's that, right? So if we are able to get the data on our own and you have a strong analytics team, you are underwriting loans, you have customer performance, you have your own book.
Yeah. Right?
So you can do a lot more with the data and technology than non-lending fintech player could do.
Right.
And I completely agree with this point about experiential learning, right? Because that is in fact true, right? Because you see a lot of different types of things happening, right? And you can never know those things unless you're on the ground. So I think a combination of technology, data, and lending, to me, I think that makes the most sense. That's the way I think most organizations would have to go.
Right.
I actually, you know, I think most banks, NBFCs will move that way.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think partly because I think they will realize that that's the way forward, but also partly due to regulation as well.
Right.
The current set of customers that you have now, you've collected, you've got fairly diverse set of data points and you've got a good sense of assessment from a behavioral standpoint. What else can be sold to them? One thing is to grow by grabbing more, sort of broadening your customer universe. The other thing is to upsell the existing universe, which you have already done a level of testing, right? What can be done there? Can be banked over and over again in multiple verticals?
Yeah, so I think, that's where, gamification for me plays a huge role. It's almost like making lending a behavior score, right?
Yeah.
Basically, you look at a customer's behavior on your book and you build a score on that behavior. And then basically, once they've been on your books for a certain amount of time and they've shown a certain amount of performance, then you basically start cross-selling to them.
Right? Yeah.
And for us, basically, the cross-selling is, as I said, one is giving them an unsecured credit line. Mm-hmm. It's a revolving line. You just use it whenever you need it. Otherwise, you don't use it.
Mm-hmm.
The second is, cross-selling personal loans to them for a variety of reasons. To our electric rickshaw customers, they need a loan every year because they need to replace their batteries and renew their insurance.
Okay.
Right. So that becomes sort of an automatic cross-sell. But a lot of geographies that we are lending in today, there's almost no NBFCs also lending. A lot of geographies we're lending in, even Bajaj Finserv doesn't exist as an example. Right. So there's a huge opportunity to actually go beyond the first lending instrument and go into lending for other things, white goods, televisions, whatever.
Right.
You very consciously took a B2C view. I think in the EV space, especially on the commercial vehicle side, a lot of financing is happening at a B2B level. People are actually going either through OEMs or through operators, and their argument is obviously that the scale in that is a completely different equation. But you kind of took a B2C route. How do you kind of square that?
Yeah, so when we look at an aggregator model and so on and so forth.
I mean, sorry, the reason why I was that it's a three-wheeler segment, so it's different. But I mean, even in three-wheeler segment, I'm guessing aggregators are kind of trying to push in, right?
Yeah, and it's three-wheelers and electric two-wheelers as well. When you have all your delivery companies wanting to move to electric and have an aggregator kind of a model.
Right.
But to me, that is largely a big city play, right? And as I said that, we are lending a lot more in tier 2, tier 3 towns. And over there, basically most people want to buy it to drive it themselves.
Right.
Right. So they are basically all micro entrepreneurs who are just buying a vehicle to basically earn a living.
Right.
Generate income, right? So they don't even have the option of basically associating themselves with any aggregators. And frankly,
And do you think the question of that problem is already solved in terms of B2B? There's sufficient capital there already?
In B2B?
I'm wondering because you are looking at a segment which is underserved, right?
Yeah.
If suppose tomorrow an Uber or someone wants to get into e3-wheelers, I'm sure they can line up guys to lend to them, right?
Yeah, I'm sure they could. It is still a problem.
Yeah.
Because a lot of companies are basically buying these vehicles on their balance sheet at the moment. So basically consuming equity for it.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, I know, are looking for companies to finance these vehicles because a lot of them have approached us as well.
Right.
Either directly to them or through them to the end driver, basically.
Right.
Right. I think it's a challenge. I think, traditional finance companies still don't understand this product. It's not a very well-developed product.
Right.
There is not much product standards around it. There is no, as you mentioned, there's no secondary market, etc. So I think getting finance is still very difficult, even for a large aggregator.
Is there, given the model, is there a reason that, is it a personal reason to focus only on the electric vehicle side of things? Would you turn down, let's say, a CNG-operated e-rickshaw potential guy who wants to...
So, we have actually been turning down CNG operators.
Okay.
Okay.
We started, I'll tell you why we started electric, right? So it was, there were three or four reasons for that. The first was, obviously, we had, at the time I started Refin, we had just returned back from the UK. This is late 2017 around Diwali time, where the air was looking really bad. And then, one day I was just sitting in the office and somebody called me and said that I have an electric three-wheeler manufacturer who wants to meet you. I said, okay, let's meet him. And then he came and said that, so we manufacture this and we sell it by the name of Kranti. And the name of our company is Refin, which is basically Revolution in Finance.
Right.
So Revolution Kranti, so there was a sort of
match.
And then, of course, air quality being what it was. And then I did some research in the market and actually found that credit penetration is very low and the market is quite scalable. So basically, that's how we made a decision to focus on this space.
Electric space.
Now, coming to CNG. Frankly, you know, at the moment, you know, our approach has been, let's just scale one segment, show that we can do it, prove that our model works, and then look at other segments.
Mm-hmm.
So we've actually been avoiding any other types of vehicles, even though a lot of people have approached us.
Right. So the reason I asked was, given how nascent we are in the EV space, especially when you think about it, you think about charging infrastructure, and the moment you talk about tier 2, tier 3 cities, I would, you know, intuitively feel the charging infrastructure will probably come last to those. Like, how do you assess that risk profile?
So here's the thing, right? I see a lot of reports, you know, that say only 8,000 EVs have sold in India in the last 5 years. That's not true.
Mm.
There are 2 million of them on the roads. And most of them are actually in very small towns and without any charging infrastructure. Because the reason is that everybody can charge these in their homes.
Yeah.
They don't need to have a specially set up charging unit for that. All right. They just then have a charger. They just plug it into the normal 15 ampere plug.
Right.
Right. And then, so my point is that, you know, this charging infrastructure is more from a personal use vehicle perspective. But when it comes to commercial use, I don't think that's needed. Because either there will be people can do it in their homes, or basically they will do it at a parking lot or whatever the case may be. Point is that, you know, people are able to find some or the other way of doing it. I don't see that as a restriction. You know, it only, if let's say I were to buy an electric vehicle, I would think about a charging station, right? Because I don't want to go through the hassle of, you know, taking a wire, a long 20 feet wire and finding a plug to pull it, etc.
Yeah.
Right? And that's okay. And therefore, I don't actually see the personal passenger electric vehicle market picking up for the next 4-5 years. But in the small commercial vehicle space, I think this market is going to explode.
Yeah. I remember having a conversation with, I think it was an Uber guy, and I was just generally asking what his take is on electric and would you move. And so I was asking the same question, charging, and he's like, and which is very surprising to me, but something that's very obvious now. He's like, no, I don't care about the charging infrastructure. I'll stop at any shop. If I go on the roadside, I'll stop at any store and I'll charge it. If I have a three-wheeler, I'll charge it. And I'm like, would you do it for me? No, even if it takes money, I'll pay him electricity charges or whatever.
Yeah.
So he was of the notion that every street, is every road has got multiple charging stations, because I can walk into any store and just request him for...
Yeah, I think it's not a question of finding charging station. It's the time that it takes to charge, basically.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I think that's the main thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, most of these, that's why I said small commercial vehicle, because they have, you know, long concentrated runs, right?
Mm.
So if you have a rickshaw driver, he does a run for 4-5 hours and then he goes and rests.
Yeah.
Right? And this 4-5 hours, he basically drives 80-200 kilometers, which is what he gets in one charge. And that's enough to, you know, for him to earn 700-800 rupees a day. And then he puts it for charge for 4-5 hours while he's having his lunch, he's resting and so on and so forth.
Mm.
And he's good to go again.
I think in a country like ours, in any ways, like, the use cases are so diverse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, you actually, if you look at, like, say, the commercial vehicle segment, you can go straight from, like, electric buses all the way to three-wheelers in the small cities.
Mm.
And, you know, everyone, like, the range and the battery requirement is different all across the value chain. So I'm assuming, like, say an electric bus would actually require maybe a centralized charging station, obviously. But in case of three-wheelers, as you go down to tier 2, tier 3 cities, even in tier 1 cities, I would imagine that is not a constraint.
No, it's not a constraint. And, you know, so if you look at tier 2, tier 3 towns, they actually had no last mile mobility options, right? So they directly leapfrogged into electric.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, basically these towns are small, right? So basically you run, your one stretch is 2 kilometers or 3 kilometers.
Right.
So basically an electric three-wheeler driver would just do 50 runs of 2 kilometer each, right?
Mm.
And basically earn 40 rupees a run. That's basically...
And the economics works for him.
Economics works fine, because the vehicle's average cost is about 1,40,000.
Right.
Right? And they have to bring a down payment of 30,000-35,000 and the rest is financed.
Mm.
So, and the net take home is 15,000-20,000 rupees a month.
How difficult was it to get equity from the driver?
No, it's not difficult. Getting equity from the driver is not difficult.
Okay, because isn't there a, like... often, this is, I think, based on a bit of press that I was reading from a B2B financer's perspective, where they were kind of, you know, putting that as a principal challenge, that, you know, getting driver equity is like something very difficult, right? That was like a challenge that they were citing. Obviously, you have a different perspective on that. You're doing it like that.
I mean, we're doing it like that, right? So, the driver has to put in
25%
equity into the vehicle, and we've not had any issue anywhere so far, right? And it's just 30-35,000 rupees that they need to bring, right? And of course, I mean, it's a big sum of money for them, but ultimately, if that helps them earn 20,000 rupees a month, then, you know, I think it makes a lot of sense for them. A lot of them maybe even borrow from friends and family to raise that initial equity,
right?
But they're able to repay in time, so I don't think repayment is an issue just because the income is so good.
Okay.
I mean, somebody living in a tier 3 town earning 15,000-20,000 rupees a month, it becomes almost a middle class in that town.
But like if you look at like a typical life cycle of the vehicle, you give a 21-month,
yeah,
right? And I guess probably, I don't know what the life of the battery is.
So life of battery, typically a lead acid battery would be a 12-month battery,
right,
which means it requires replacement. So there's an additional 20,000 rupee cost at the end of 12 months.
Right. So that kind of is included in the quote-unquote loan product, right?
So we're not, so we are including it in some products, not
right,
all of them.
Right.
But we're happy for them to come back to us and, you know, take another loan
like,
for that battery.
Refund.
So we'll just give them a top up on the loan.
Right. By that time, you already know their profiles.
Correct. I mean, 12 months of performance is very good.
Well,
right?
Yeah. What is, how is the overall in credit?
Yeah, that's what I was actually about to head into. Like,
yeah.
like you mentioned that you have an NBFC.
Yeah. So what's the environment like? What challenges are you seeing? I mean, we're still looking at spillover effects from the NBFC whole showdown, but how are you seeing the market?
So I think it is challenging to raise money from the market, whether it's equity or debt. Both of them are challenging for the lending sector. One, obviously, because it's a very capital intensive model, so you require money. I mean, money is the raw material, right? So you need it all the time.
Yeah.
Second is obviously whatever crisis happened late last year, there's a spillover effect of that, and it's not gone away fully, because even though there's a lot of I suppose government push into bringing more liquidity into the market, it's still going into the top end of the market. So
right,
like these AAA rated big NBFCs probably are getting money, but they would anyway be able to raise the money. But
right,
but small firms like us, I think it is quite challenging to raise money, because we're not even rated, because we're quite new. So
right,
last year it becomes very challenging to raise money at a cost that we can afford,
right?
Because ultimately if the cost of borrowing is very high, then the cost of our lending also becomes very
sure,
high,
right?
And then the loan is not sustainable for the customer anymore.
It's very interesting, because I think it was a season, one or two seasons ago, when we were generally, like, entrepreneurs are phenomenally
optimistic, yes,
right? Like I think you have to wear like blinders, right?
Correct.
In order to operate.
Absolutely.
Otherwise it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But you I think you come from a credit background. You do seem to recognize where things are off.
I'm also optimistic. But I mean, there are real challenges that we face, but that doesn't mean we are stopping because of that. So that's the optimism part.
Right.
But of course there's a bit of a reality as well.
Yeah.
And I basically a very interesting quote from somebody.
Hmm.
They said, if you look ahead, you'll see a wall.
Hmm.
Right? There's no way to go anywhere.
Hmm.
Okay? But don't stop.
Mm.
Keep going. When you reach the wall, you'll basically find another way leading somewhere else.
Right.
And I think that's how we are operating, right? So we're
right,
not stopping, we're just going. And frankly, even though I say it's difficult to raise money, touch wood, we've never had to stop operations because of no money.
Got it.
Right? So we always managed to raise some, but
got
it's
it,
just that, you know, you don't have a sustainable flow at a very cheap rate available.
Right.
I think that's the challenge, basically.
Let's wear like an analyst hat for a moment. Let's forget you're doing RefFin.
Mm.
And you're looking at the NBFC space at large, right? There are obviously a few bad apples.
Yeah.
But systemically, do you think, you keep on hearing a narrative that post demonetization, obviously, like traditional banks were flush with deposits,
yeah,
then they moved to shadow banking, and
yes,
shadow banking kind of, and obviously, traditional banks were getting hit by the NPA crisis themselves. So, shadow banks, NBFCs kind of, you know, took the road forward, and there was a lot of bad, poor lending which happened. That's the narrative that you often see, especially in like a left-leaning economist or whatever, right? I don't know what your thoughts are. That is it like just a case of a DHFL or ILFS who are kind of just spoiling the entire story for everyone else? Or do you actually see some, without naming names,
yeah,
but just...
No, there's a lot that's already been said about this.
Hmm.
And it's very clear that, you know, there are a few bad apples, yes.
Yeah.
But a lot of companies have done very well in the last couple of years as well.
Right.
Few very large NBFCs have done extremely well.
Hmm.
So I think from a sectoral standpoint, I think the story is still quite good, very bullish.
Right.
And also I see a slight shift happening now, which is that, you know, 2-3 years back, everybody was talking about corporate lending, SME lending,
yeah,
but nobody was talking about consumer lending.
Right.
But I actually now see a lot of big players also focusing a lot more on consumer lending, because I think consumer lending is where the bigger opportunity is, and also because of the risk diversification that we spoke about, you know, the instance of bad debt or NPAs is also quite low.
Mm.
So I think a lot of shift is happening in that space, and I think it's absolutely the right thing to happen.
Right. And in terms of, you also, there's also a narrative on a consumer slowdown, right? It's been, one can look at supply numbers for the past 18 months.
Mm.
Supply numbers were showing a shift.
Yeah.
Now the demand numbers are kind of, they have caught up. And I think anyone who's in the market knew this was coming,
mm,
right? I mean, but on ground, in terms of from a consumption player perspective, do you see what are the kind of trends that you see? Because you are looking at like the hinterland, right? You are also looking at those very specifically uncovered parts of the country, right, which doesn't come into mainstream narrative.
Yeah, so I mean, of course, you know, numbers obviously say that there's a huge reduction in consumer demand. I'm sure there is. But you know, when I look at the markets that we operate in, when I look at the kind of products that we are landing for,
right,
there's growth happening.
Right.
Right, beyond doubt. And you know, I think it's from a lending perspective, I think it's more to do with the purpose of the loan. You know, why are you giving the loan? And a lot of the loans that we give is basically for a productive purpose. It's for income generation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you know, frankly, when there is a decline in employment or consumer demand, people right. do look for alternative income generation alternatives, right? And I think the kind of loans we are doing actually supports that. So from our perspective, we just see growth, and I think that will continue.
Right.
It's sort of also getting a feel, like, based on what we read, like, there is an international VCPE mindset of trying to get some exposure to the Indian EV ecosystem right now. Mm. I mean, you can get exposure to the Indian EV ecosystem in so many different ways.
Mm.
But is that something that you're seeing as well, or that, you know, how does Revfin sort of slot into that?
No, actually, I don't see that. I see that, let's put it this way. Until a few months back, there was not much interest. In the last 6-8 months, I've started seeing interest.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see many VCs, PEs actually having a view on the market, right? Everybody's thinking about the market, trying to understand the market, but they've not formulated a view yet.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And therefore, the big equity infusion into the segment is not happening, either for OEMs or for lending companies like us, etc. Yes, it is happening in the aggregator space.
Yeah.
I see that happening. I guess because those models are less capex heavy, I think it's easier to invest in those models.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of money needs to come into the OEM space and as well as lending space. I think that's not happening today. I think that will happen probably in a few months when most of these institutions have taken a view on the market. And also EV spaces, you know, it's a very unstructured space right now. So there's not enough data available on Google about it. Right, so you actually have to go to a small town to understand how this is playing out.
Right.
You can't do it sitting in your office.
Right.
And I think that's what some of the institutions need to start doing now.
I think in terms of capital intensity, one is like being a funder like you guys, right? Another is like being an OEM. From an OEM perspective also, I guess there is a... Everyone is, I think, waiting and watching,
correct,
right? And I think from an Indian OEM perspective, there's an entire issue of the entire EV value chain as well, right? And
correct,
most guys are assembly plays at the end of the day, right? There are very few who are doing end-to-end. I don't know if there are any, frankly.
Well, there are a few end-to-end
right.
people who are manufacturing as well.
Right.
Not everything.
Right.
You know, I mean, the electrical parts are still imported from China.
Yeah.
The mechanical parts are manufactured in India.
Right.
By the OEM or through one of their suppliers. And right. obviously, there's the battery component.
Right. Right.
The problem is, you know, again, you know, the market is just so unstructured. We don't know what is a good product versus a bad product. We don't have any crash tests.
Right.
We do have an ICAT or an ARAI approval, but beyond that, there's nothing, right? We don't know what is the secondary market. We don't know what is the life of the product, right? Is it going to last 2 years, 3 years, 10 years, no one knows, right? So I think there are a few challenges.
Do you think the government needs to intervene more? I mean, they're intervening at a lot of levels, but I mean, but I think the policy environment is still volatile, right, around EVs. I mean, there are, when you look at like vehicular standards, they are still a work in progress. And there's a lot of flip-flop which happens. I mean, that's at least my personal view.
No, there is a lot of flip-flop, but even the flip-flop is also because nobody has a complete understanding of what is right and what will work in the future. And that market needs to develop. I think the government can do only so much, right? Ultimately, the market has to figure out its own way. And, you know, even with some of the policy interventions, I think some of the policy interventions are good. But again, you know, they're not holistic and probably not necessarily appropriate for the market.
I mean, the biggest policy intervention, I guess, is like in a few segments, there's a demand just being kind of brought in from the government side, right? And there are obviously subsidies and incentives which are coming in. And I guess I think the view in India often is that, okay, let's look in our neighborhood, right? So I mean, you have the Chinese case study, which is obviously very state-driven in every sector, right? And in EV, obviously, they are probably the most, I would say, evolved market, so as to say. But there, the government-heavy approach was taken, probably a function of their system. But you don't see that.
So this is my view, right? I mean, government obviously should do as much as it can for any sector.
Hmm.
But ultimately, You know, the policy push from the government started happening a few months back, maybe last year sometime, with the GST reduction and with the FAME 1, FAME 2,
right,
especially FAME 2 with the subsidies, etc.
Right.
But the reality is that 1.5 million units had already been sold by that time. And to me, that is happening because of the pure economics of the product.
Right.
Right. I think the people who are buying the product don't care about the environment necessarily.
Right.
And they don't care about the government policy also necessarily.
Right.
I think what they care about is this product giving us a decent chance to earn a good income?
Right.
And that it is.
Right.
Right. So I think irrespective of whether there's government push or not, these products will continue to sell.
Right.
Right. I think the only question is at what pace does it grow? And that's where government can do a few things.
Right.
Right. For example, a lot of these vehicles were being financed under the Mudra scheme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. I think that can be pushed a little bit more.
Okay.
Because I think the Mudra loan is actually quite good for the end customer. The interest rates are very low.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it's with the public sector bank, etc. So I think if the government pushes that, I think that will do more for the sector than having a subsidy, as an example.
I'll give you a flip argument, right? Mm-hmm. In case of Mudra, there's also like noise around rising NPS there now,
mm-hmm.
isn't there? So I mean, like, isn't the push kind of also leading to unstructured or poor underwriting practice?
The ticket sizes are roughly the same as well,
yeah,
right?
So I think you know, when you do a push, doesn't mean you have to compromise on procedures.
But unfortunately, that's how it often transpires, right? I mean, if suppose there is like a if tomorrow, say, there's a major announcement, you typically see a sudden rush. I mean, implementation always, I think, suffers when an ambitious target is announced, correct?
Yeah, which is fine. I think even if I look at the Mudra loan as an example for electric vehicles, the policy is so inconsistent even within a particular bank.
Okay.
Right? Each branch would have its own sort of policy or in terms of how much volume they can do or not, what they cannot do, etc.
Right.
So I think when you launch a new scheme or a new policy, I think implementation of that becomes quite important, and to do it consistently across all your distribution network is important. I think if that happens, if it happens properly, I think it will work.
So on principle, you are kind of pro Mudra.
Oh, absolutely, 100%.
Right, right.
I think for the end user, it's a brilliant product.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, the kind of interest rates at 8-9% reducing interest rate. Somebody who's taking a loan for the first time in a tier 2-3 town, for them to get that interest rate, I think it's wonderful.
So, what is next for Refin? What keeps you up at night, and what are near term to medium term and then long term sort of ambitions? Just grow the book. I mean, that's obviously fairly intuitive target which you never reach. It keeps moving.
So the good news is nothing keeps me up at night except on Netflix sometimes.
Yeah,
right.
But from a Refin perspective, I think the idea is quite simple, that we want to scale the EV segment more.
Mm-hmm.
In 2019, we probably will end up financing about 1,500 units.
Okay.
In 2020, we actually want to scale that a lot more, to do about 20,000 units.
Okay, wow.
Right. So that's the kind of scale we see. So I think we've set up a very robust platform and a process to do that. And we are now in an auto-run mode where we can actually start scaling that segment. And then beyond that, we want to start exploring a few more segments. We want to look at electric two-wheelers more for small commercial usage. And then start looking at other types of consumer lending. Hopefully, we started with unsecured consumer loans.
Mm-hmm.
We want to look at that again as well in the coming year. I think all of that depends on our ability to raise money.
Yeah.
And if you're able to do that successfully, I think we can grow at a very good pace and without actually compromising on credit quality.
Yeah. And in terms of geographies, I know tier 2, tier 3 cities, but you want to sort of go north-south, or is there any
target
market?
When I look at electric vehicle, it only sells mostly in the northern part of the country.
Okay.
And that too, UP, Bihar mostly, and West Bengal as well. I think southern states, western states, hopefully will start adopting electric vehicles a lot more. So we will sort of follow that route.
Right.
And of course, in the existing states, we'll penetrate the markets further.
Yeah. Well, no, that was a delightful chat, Sameer. I think as usual, we kind of went a bit deep in your business, but then we ended up touching a lot of other associated issues. I hope you had a good time. I think an Earl Grey tea is due, already stacked up for you. No, thank you so much for your time, and this has been a great chat, Sharath. What do you think?
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's been an interesting space. It's a space that we try to look at as well, and like it. Fairly interesting space. So it was thank you so much for your time. It was an absolute pleasure, and time has actually flown, so we
didn't realize. It's been long, I guess.
Yeah, it's about, we're nearing 55 minutes.
Brilliant. And with on that note, I think it's time to remind our subscribers to obviously subscribe, to also comment on our podcast, you know, give us a nice rating. Samir obviously would give a nice rating now, I'm sure about that. And yeah, please do give us your feedback in order to make these interactions better. And another shout out is we are kind of scaling up our team, and we are looking very keenly for a full stack developer in Transfin. We'll put the link in the description, so do you know, share and spread the word, so that we can, you know, continue increasing the quality of our of an eclectic mix of curated offerings that we present.
Yeah,
and thank you so much. This is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Tupran
signing off.